Welcome back to this session. As usual, I start a bit early. My chit-chat session. I persevere to see whether I can get some audience participation. And so we are at the first class of this course, which I call Appreciating Your Life. So the last two sessions we talk about appreciating our precious human life. So for both of you attended. is there any question or any comment from what we have covered today? Do you appreciate your life more? Usually when I use the 10 Dharma classes, one year in, one year out. When I used to take notes, to scribble something on the notebook, but I rely on what I call imprint consolation. After that, you cannot remember anything, right? So you just console yourself. Oh, it's all right. There'll be imprints of my mind. The imprints are the only thing left. But you cannot access the imprints. They're so subtle that you cannot retrieve them. So when people ask you, hey, what kind of venerable so and so, what did he or she taught us? Oh, I don't know. But they are imprinted, they will be imprinted. Not to worry. So I call them the imprint constellation. So later I decided that I should encourage people to think a bit differently. Sometimes it's like, even if you fall asleep, you also think that they are imprinted. So then I encourage people that instead of remembering everything, just remember one thing. Then 6 points, try to remember one of them. Then they die of discount. So if instead of for one class, you remember 1 point. Maybe for an entire course, you remember one thing for the entire course. So discount, isn't it? I mean, if you don't remember anything from that entire course, then it's like, alright. and I think that is, I actually thought that in a way is a good idea, because even this particular way, the point of something that impressed you, something that caught your attention, and if you were to come back to it over a period of time, meditate, then there will be benefits to come from it. So not to underestimate that one point. But I used to teach this course, this text called Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, Bodhicharyavatara. Quite a long text, 10 chapters. And each chapter has about 150 verses. Yeah. I used to teach it in 10 weeks. 10 sessions, and I do this the same idea. Each chapter, everything you can remember, everything right. So, no need to talk too much. So, I only talk on one verse. Okay? So, then we cover 10 chapters in 10 sessions. You finish the book. Wonderful is that you feel a sense of accomplishment that you have covered this book. When my teacher, Rambha Sangeetadru, used to talk this, I think at least we'll take up. More than a year, because you should go through the whole text, just faithfully go through every text, every verse, unlike me, I just think. And they're not going to remember, so just pick a few that is, pick the easy one to explain. Just explain it, and there you go, one session. So if you remember that one word from each chapter, it's an accomplishment. So it's easy to feel accomplished. So once again, any feedback? Any commercial ask for feedback, yeah. Because recently there was some research, social science research to say the feedback doesn't work. I agree. So we can forget about the feedback. So any comments or anything about your precious time? Do you appreciate your life more? Okay, so it'll be too early. So that whole topic of appreciating your human life. Naturopath traditionally is about your or our precious human rebirth. Human rebirth, because it's set in the context of Buddhist teaching of multiple lives, multiple rebirths. So this is one among the many of them, yes. But when I start to present this, especially when I was teaching in Sydney, now that I'm lazy, I don't really want to get into this whole debate of is there rebirth, or is there not rebirth, and then if there is rebirth, how many rebirths, and you'll be surprised that there are many different ideas floating around about reincarnation, and about rebirth. There's this whole idea of Akashic records. Have you heard of this? Accessing your Akashic records. Which is the record of all your past, present, and future. It's all there. It's like a library or encyclopedia where you can tap into it and pull it out. So that is that's one way some people conceptualize multiple lives. Let's say your lives, all your multiple lives are already in the record. Then there are others that think that rebirth is a learning journey. You each time you learn a lesson, you move on. And if you fail to learn your lesson, you go round and round and round. None of those are really Buddhist ideas. Okay. So it gets a bit complicated when even if you use a simple word like rebirth, actually people can understand it in many different ways. So as I said, lazy one. So I decided that I'll leave that topic another time. Like, for example, maybe the last session of this talk, because we're going to talk about death, right? I suppose we should also spend some time talking about the afterlife, the rebirth. But that comes later. So I find that it's much easier to synthesize the topic and talk about our precious human life. But in any way, we are in this life. Look at the future. The auspicious features of this life, and to sort of appreciate what we have here. The whole idea is so that we can make better use of it, make full use of it to this meaning to life. So, I'm going to start. It's very different. Yeah. Wait for the record. So, this is a series of classes. Based on the title called Experiencing the Buddha's Teaching. So the Buddha fought for 45 years. He is the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, fought for 45 years. Quite usually in a very impromptu manner, but he will be sitting there and people will come up to the chat. And this could be his followers, his disciples, monks, nuns, lay people. It can also be people who is curious. The gossip goes around the village that some holy man has arrived, you know, like outside, you know, and then you have nothing to do, right? And then you say, okay, let's go around, let's go and see, you know, with this holy man, and maybe we can get some blessing and things like that. I mean, nowadays, because of the case, 2000 times, maybe, I think the hugging saint is coming to the do you know of that? It's an Indian saint, she hugs people. Well, like 17 hours, different people, 400. So, like, something like that. So, nowadays you have banners along Serangoon Road, and then you have the internet and all this advertising. But in the old days, there isn't, so by word of mouth, people talk about it, they spread among the village, and then there are people who are interested in some stuff, and then among a holy person. And so, so they may not be Buddhist to say, but they were went to see the Buddha and talk to the Buddha. So in the sutras, the discourses, you can see people came with different attitudes. Some are very respectful, others are like respectful in the sense that regarding the Buddha as their teacher. Others are respectful in the sense that they just respect you for the spiritual practitioner. And then the others are pretty rude. walked up and then sit there and say, "Help me, what do you have to say?" Something like that. So different attitudes. And so the teachings were preserved. And many years later, Buddhist teacher starts to organize the teaching in a way that is easier for newcomers, easier for everybody to access them. Because they're just like different conversations. They all just, there are different ways they compile it, but one funny way is in terms of numbers. So all those things that talk about one thing, goes into chapter one. So all those discourses talk about two things, goes into chapter two, all the way up to chapter 11. So this is called, this collection is called the numerical collection, based on numbers. Then others are based on the length, the long discourse, the middle discourse. And then there's one that's called connected discourse, which is based on topics. But these are difficult for most of us to read through all these teachings. So past masters have been very kind. They extract some of the main ideas and they arrange in some meaningful way. One of that is what we are looking at in this course now. And it originated or it's primarily from Tibetan Buddhist tradition. It's called Lamrim in Tibetan. Or it's literally means the path to enlightenment. Or sometimes we call it the graduated path to enlightenment. So basically we arrange the topic in a systematic way so that you study and reflect each one of them. And as you progress it, it brings you, it's all goes from basic to advanced, like for ideas. So we are starting at the beginning here. And each of the topics or theme is together the different teachings together. Just to ask, present it so that for us we learn about it and hopefully we think about it, we reflect on it. And then we meditate. So that's a three-step process of learning, with reflecting or reflection, thinking, and then finally meditation, which is to do with summarizing. So, for example, in the previous two classes, I present a topic called appreciating our passions in life. So I present some ideas. Okay. So hopefully, we take some time to think about it. Do I agree with this? What does it mean? How does it apply to me? Yeah. And then when you come to some kind of your own understanding, your own conclusion, that's when we meditate. It's noisy, but very touchy. So ideally, we actually reflect on what we heard, or we read about, or we learned about, and we really try to understand it with respect to ourselves. Is this true? Do I believe in it? Do I agree with it? And when you come to your own kind of understanding, you meditate. The meditation step is to summarize the self material is to sort of imprint it deeper with the aim of bringing about a change in yourself, a change in your perspective, a change in your attitude, your thinking, your feeling, and eventually also the way you behave. So that's how we experience the Buddha's teaching in our own life. And so that's the process. But most of the time, including myself, we might spend quite a bit of time with the first step of learning or studying or reading, watching, listening to podcasts or watching YouTube videos or whatever. Yeah. So the first class is more information gathering. And then we jump to the last step, meditation. So there is this middle step that is usually not done, this step of reflection. Contemplation, thinking about it. Really thinking, not just repeating the information, but thinking in a way that tries to link that information that we receive with our own experience and to examine from our point of view, evaluate whether it is true or not. Now, there's a good reason why we don't do it, because it's difficult. It is takes time, it takes energy, and it's not easy. It's not easy to question the information and say, is this true? It's not easy to try to relate that information with our actual experience. So it's much easier to just by sponge, just absorb the information and just store it somewhere. And so our modern examination, if you go and do this one, Buddhist examination, doesn't help, because all you need to do is to squeeze that sponge and regurgitate out the information onto the paper, and then you get distinction. I used to regret not studying Buddhist studies during my secondary school. This is a long, long time ago when I used to do religious study. I studied Confucius ethics. I get very confused. For 2 years, I'm not actually sure what the heck am I studying. So I was quite blurred by that. Then my friends say, you should study Buddhism. Even Bible study is easier. It's easier to get paid. That's the only thing I aim for. I wasn't a Buddhist at that time. I missed out. So, you notice that a lot of the time, the process of thinking for ourselves, thinking on our own feet, that didn't happen. So when that didn't happen, eventually you end up with a condition of indigestion. So you just swallow everything, and they were not digested. They were not kind of, you didn't separate out what is the essence or what is what you can relate to yourself and what is irrelevant, not something that you can use. So you don't have that process of digestion, and therefore there's no process of assimilation. You didn't absorb the really good stuff, and you didn't integrate it. It didn't become a part of you. It sort of forever remains a little bit foreign. So that it stays with you, but it's not, it's sort of a little bit separate from who you are and how you think, you and how you behave. And so that is a major issue. And if that happens, then you realize that although you know about the Buddha's teaching, you don't actually experience the Buddha's teaching in your own life. You don't actually kind of, you don't find that you are embodying that teaching, or it kind of becomes part of you. It has not had that deep impact. So the aim of this series is I wanted to explore together how we can overcome this problem in digestion. So you have a better digestive system, you really digest it, and you assimilate, you integrate it, and then you benefit from the nutrients that come from it. It's something really nurturing to you. Something that further down the road you can look back and you say, wow, I have really benefited from the study, the practice. But no problem. No. So what we now, when we do meditation, what we call meditation, this whole series, it will be more or less double up as like reflection as well. Because like, today I'm going to talk about a new topic, but death. Right? So maybe you never think about death. So when we meditate on death, then it becomes almost like a chance to Think about it. Not so much about familiarizing, not so much about the third step, but just the second step of feeling a process of just give it some thought. Think about it, contemplate it, and start to see whether is there any relevance to yourself, to your life. Do you agree with it? Do you don't agree with it? So today's topic is on death. Something called death awareness. And important to say right at the beginning that the whole point of talking about death in the Buddhist context, and then reflecting and meditating on it, is not to get you to be afraid of death. It's not to arouse fear of death. Because we already have it instinctively. Okay? I used to not believe then there are occasions when the fear of death was triggered. It just came out of nowhere. And then I say, oh, I'm afraid to die. Okay. So, I think fear of death is quite instinctive. As an organism, we do have this instinctive reaction to fear death. And therefore, we value life. We try to survive. That's part of our instinct. And, death awareness, talking about death in the Buddhist context, is not about increasing that fear. Not to get you to be so scared of death. That's not the aim of it. Although, in the process, maybe it might press a button and maybe it might trigger some apprehension, some fear, some uncomfortable feeling. And so that may happen. And then when that happens, then you can always decide whether what to do about it. But as I want to emphasize, the aim is not to scare you, not to make you more afraid of that. The aim of talking about dance, reflecting on it, meditating on it, is that it is a very powerful topic and it can really transform our life. It can actually change our perspective. I'm sure you heard of many real life stories. You might have read about it. You might have even seen movies made about it, about how confronting death can transform a person's life, can make people take another look at what they have been doing in their life, and then make changes in their life, even make drastic changes in the life of death. And the result can be something very positive. It enhance maybe help you to realign how you live your life with what you want to achieve with your life. So it's a very powerful topic. The Buddha said that he gave this analogy. Among all the land animals, the footprint of the elephant is supreme at this point. Because I'm not very sure whether it's true, but let's say it's true. Okay. So the footprint of the Buddha, of the elephant, is supreme among all the land animals. And likewise, the contemplation of death is the supreme among all contemplation, all reflection. Because if you do it well, it can have a very profound effect on how we live our life. And it can, funny enough, actually help us to live happier, more contented, more meaningful life. So there are great benefits that come out of talking about that, reflecting on that. In this topic, I want to emphasize another way we can work with this information. So the previous two sessions, the first session is talking about recognizing your precious human life. I give you an image. Later we meditate on the image of just taking a trip down memory lane. Imagine the river of your life. You take a cruise down, or cruise out, whatever. And then along the way you recollect different episodes, different aspects of your own life. And you collect you leave the rubbish behind and you collect the gems. People are very interesting. They're like, I ask them to collect gems and they think about the rubbish. They're all just, this is not good, that one looks terrible, this is I'm not happy about. But the gem, okay? So leave the rubbish there and then collect the gem. Identify certain events or certain aspects of your life that when you bring to mind, you say, wow, this is a wonderful life. You collect the rubbish. It would be very hard to say, oh, this is a wonderful life. You would say, this is a rubbish life, right? It depends on what you collect along the way. Yeah. So that is using an image to guide your reflection, your thinking. And then last week, we used another device, which is a guiding question. So you just ask yourself this question and ask it a bit deeper, not just on the intellectual level. Ask yourself this question, like, what do I want to do? Or what do I want to achieve? This life. So you just repeat that question and allow the question to stimulate different ideas and images to come up for your consideration. And that is another way we work with the information, we process it, and then we try to familiarize ourselves with it. Just as you do this, measure, you'll be able to see, you drop, if you have a well, and you don't know what's inside that well, there's no very few well in all, but how do you know it? You pick a piece of stone and you drop it, and then you listen to the response, right? If you hear the sound of water, is on, there's water in the well. You hear, the most probably the well is dry, right? And you hear, ouch, then you know there's a human being at the bottom. Okay? So you drop the question into the well of your own heart and mind. You listen to what comes forth in response to it. What do I want to achieve with this question from my heart? So maybe different things might come forth and for you to consider or reconsider. So today I want to present this topic on death using another device, a very popular device, using a list. L-I-S-T, a list. If you study Buddhism, you must study a list, list, and list, and list. Right? If you have not encountered a single list, don't say you study Buddhism. Because everything, almost everything in Buddhism, is preserved, presented in list. Seven factors are life, 37 factors are life, the three root poisons, the six afflictions, the 20 secondary afflictions. Everything is in the list. Okay? So lists are very powerful device. Because in this context, we are going to look at a few lists. If you go down a list, you think according to the different components of the list, it is doing something to your attention, doing something to your mind. See, a list is a way of directing your attention in a certain way. So there are different types of lists. Okay? So later, I'm going to advantages of thinking about death. So I'll give you, like the six advantages. So you, this is six items that are all related to the same theme. Why is it so advantageous, so beneficial to think about death? So you basically are sending your attention down a list six times. Each time it's trying to convince you, it's very good to think about death. It's very good to think about death. It's very good to think about death. Right? Six times. Then if the list gets longer, you will basically, you know, it's a way of persuading, a way of influencing your attention. I'm sure. Unless you study Buddhism, it's very rare you ever can encounter a list that tells you, it's very good to think about death, right? But if you were to set your attention, you follow the list. It's kind of, I think of it as you create a kind of a tunnel or conduit. And you channel your energy or your attention down this pipe, right? And it has a certain aim. It goes somewhere, right? Like a pipe, or one end. You come in one end, you go up the other end, right? By where, however you orientate the pipe, in a way, you are directing your attention to land somewhere, to go towards some conclusion. So that is the power of the list. Never underestimate the power of the list. Okay? In this case, the list directs your attention to the conclusion that, oh, if you agree with it, it's actually very good to meditate on that, and to think about that. And then, later we have another list, what to think about that, how to think about it. And that is a 9-point meditation on that. That nine, another list, 9 points. And by the time you've gone through that, you again channel your attention in a certain way. It brings you closer to a certain kind of conclusion. So that's the power of using a list. But before you do that, you should be careful about this. You should make sure that it is going in the direction that you want, that you agree with, and that it is something that you have checked and reset, and you think that it is true. Otherwise, you may end up in a place where you don't really want to be, right? Okay, so that is something you should keep in mind. Just as a list, using a list can channel your attention. What it's also doing is limiting your attention. It limits your attention, let's say, only to think what is the advantages of thinking about that. You didn't talk about what might be harmful or unhelpful to think about that. You wouldn't see it in that list. But you might experience it. You get a little bit paranoid. I didn't go out today. I might just die. You know, and after all, death can happen at any time. So it can have other effects. But that is not mentioned in that list. So, this is just something I thought bring to your attention. Both the power, and when there is power, then there is a proper way of using it, and there is also a way of misusing it. So, be careful on this. So, what is so beneficial? Why is it so beneficial to think of that? Why we, Buddhism, we emphasize it so much? It is said that there are six benefits, if I can remember them. The first one is, if you don't think about that, it's also very likely you don't think about the Dharma, is the Buddha's teaching, or you can broaden it and say, it's likely that you don't think at all about spiritual practice, spiritual cultivation. You get very easily caught up in the busyness of day-to-day life, just getting on, getting by, getting things done, all our responsibilities and commitments. And so, if you think about that, that kind of routine can take over. And you can spend an entire life doing that until on your deathbed. You say, hey, this is not what I want to do in my life. Sorry, it's too late. Yeah. Okay, so, according to the Buddha, if you don't think about death, it is less likely that you will think about the Dharma, you think about spiritual practice. And the second one is, you don't think about death, and of course, then if you don't think about it, you don't have it. I always don't have time to meditate. Okay, so then, even though you might have think about it, study the Dharma, but you don't practice it. There's other things, there's always something else more urgent. Not necessarily more important, but all more urgent that you have to do. So you don't practice. And even if you, that's one thing I hate about this, because then you miss an item. And, even if you do practice, you don't practice wholeheartedly or all the time. During my annual leave, I will practice. Otherwise, too busy, I don't know. Okay. So you don't practice all the time. The fourth advantage is if you think about that, you or your practice will also be a pure practice. But if you don't think of that, your practice can be influenced by other things. Like keeping up appearance. When I go to a meditation course, I must sit on the floor. Cannot sit on the chair. Don't look good, you know. I must try to sit cross leg like to show that I'm a meditator. Okay. You'll be surprised how strong that tendency is. So then, the practice of meditation is now somehow affected by other considerations. Keeping up appearance, keeping others company, and why you come, they all come, so I come along, I don't want to be left out. I used to do that also, right? Oh, this Lama is, don't know who this Lama is. Never mind that they all go, so I also go along, social outing. Otherwise, because otherwise nobody want to meet up with me, and you all want this special Lama in town, then we all go. So before that and after that, you have your social kind of meeting and chatting, gossiping. Then in the middle is supposedly holy encounter. So they used to be, this day I just do that, really. There used to be a lot of Lamas transiting Singapore. So it's okay, this one here, and that one there, and we're all over the shop, basically. So there's so many that you sort of get confused. You don't know what is what. Okay, so without thinking of that, it's easy for Dharma practice or spiritual practice to be influenced by other considerations. But if you are very mindful of that, then practice becomes much simpler and purer. But then it becomes a way of living a only two lies free of regret in preparation for that. Okay, so there's four advantages of thinking of death. The fifth one is, if we don't think of death, it's easy for us to just give in to our old habits, especially bad habits, which just go along. We used to lie, so we just keep lying. Why change, right? So the teaching says it's easy to engage in non-virtuous action. But if we are mindful of that, then we are also mindful of how the choices we make and how we want to live our life, whether these are something that I might end up regretting later on. So we become more aware. We are less likely to engage in non-virtuous action. And the sixth is that you remember that most probably when the time death actually arrives, you can go known with death. But that you're aware of it, so you live your life in such a way that you make choices, you do things that what you really want to do in this life. And so by the time death arrives for you, you have no regret. Because you all along, by being mindful of the fact of death, you have been doing the very thing that you want to do, make the choices, going in the direction that you have set for yourself. So in the light of death, you can live your life with no regret. So this is the list of why is it so beneficial. Convinced? Not convinced. Maybe sometimes we come across there's some books that are really wonderful. I think one of them, When Air Becomes Breath, or something like that. I never read it, but I heard about it. It's written by the memoir of a neurosurgeon, a very, very intelligent man. And I think by dying from a brain tumor. So he studied, he was very promising young man. And then he was diagnosed with terminal illness. So that memoir becomes the record of the last few months of the period of his life. Yeah. So, and then, not uncommon for people, especially when they have cancer, usually there is a kind of, cancer is a strange illness. For most people, there is a period of time, especially now with advanced treatment, where they know they're dying, but they're not dead. That is a period while they're receiving treatment, where they can do some rethinking about their life. Or if people survive cancer, they also think about a change of heart. They want to, now that they have like a second life, they get to rethink whether or how I want to live my life. So those are some practical situations where people are forced to think about that in the face of death, and how sometimes that whole process can be a very positive process, a positive experience. But here we're trying to bring a more milder way. So we actually have a terminal illness diagnosis, and we're telling you you'll be dead in 6 months or 6 weeks. So hopefully you don't have to do that, don't have to go through that agony of that. We still have a kind of luxury of time. We think we have a luxury of time. Then by voluntarily thinking of that, then we can maybe benefit then from that. Okay? So that's why we are talking about death. We spent 3 weeks talking about it. Maybe there's been nobody around. I didn't tell people that we are talking about death. That's a trick. Never tell them that. But actually, funny enough, all these years of teaching Buddhism, I think something to do with Buddhism and death, okay? When you advertise a course about death, usually you have, it's very popular. There are a lot of people coming. Talk about karma, nobody comes. They all know about karma already. They don't need to come and listen to you. But death is somehow it's the kind of thing that we fear. And yet we're also very fascinated about it. We're very compassionate.
telling.
And some of the attendant stuff will shut up. After a while, it becomes, go back to the Buddhist topic, right, when plunge in. They don't really want to be Buddhist, but they just want to see what Buddhists would say about that. That might be beneficial for them. So, the way of reflecting death in the Buddhist context, sometimes presented in what's called the 9-point meditation. So there's another list of 9 points. They're divided into three sections, or three categories. The first category is related to how death is unavoidable, or inevitable for each one of us. We all have to die. And under this, there are 3 points. I'll just talk about it. First is that there's no escape from death for every one of us. Definitely going to die. Everyone is going to die. Like, you get a kick out of it. Yeah. This is a very, it's a very surprising common sense. Everybody knows that. But it's surprisingly, just by repeating that, thinking about it, it's a surprisingly difficult idea to stick in our mind. We seem to have some kind of Teflon or non-stick thing. No matter how you say it, you know, you see people die in front of you, at the funeral, and this kind of thing. Somehow this sort of slides off. All the time. There was one, it was in Australia, a traffic light, person turned green, right, about to walk, right. So I just delayed for, I was a bit slow reaction, so I delayed for a split second, and then this huge truck went, vroom! Okay, I almost died. Of course, I crossed the road, right? After a while, I forgot about it. But there's a few seconds where the impact of the reality of death, just less than a meter, maybe half a meter away from me. And yet, after that, I forgot about it. After a few more steps, then I back to the dreaming. But the notion of death is life. Okay. So, but this reflection is to see whether we can make it think a bit deeper, see whether we can bring up something beneficial. So, everyone, the first point is everyone of us has to die. There's no escape and no exception. At least not until now. Yeah. Unless you, like, Chinese Taoist belief, right? Yeah. Buddhism, no such thing. Okay. So everyone has died. So if you want to live forever, Buddhism is not the place to come. Okay? You go practice Taoism. Taoist Neigong or something like that. Yin, San. Okay? Second one is that even while we are alive, our lifespan is continuously increasing. It's not like, and this is a very interesting one. There's no way of increasing your life. You're not going to add a few more years to it. And yet every day, whether you are awake or asleep, continuously depreciating, continuously decreasing. We don't know when the end is going to come, but we are moving. And the Tibetan teaching, Tibetan nomadic, right? So they travel around on orders. There's this image that when you travel, you do stop right at night, you stop, you pitch a tent, and you rest. So there is a period where you don't travel. You're not traveling closer to your death during the night time. But on this on the highway of life, death, you are always traveling. Whether you are awake, you are asleep, you are continuously moving closer and closer to the final death. And the third one is, and even when we are alive, and we are moving closer and closer to the inevitable death, we still don't spend much time practicing. We're still not devoting putting aside time and energy for our own spiritual cultivation from the Dharma, from the Buddhist perspective. Another way of looking at it, people always say, now I'm very busy. I'll practice the Dharma later. I'll practice the Dharma when I retire. This is the famous one. When I retire, I do this or do that, and when you retire, don't do any of that. Yeah. So, we postpone, or we somehow feel that there will always be enough time to do this or that, to practice the Dharma. Yes, they think that time is running out. We are moving closer and closer to our own death. And that's because it's not going to sort of wait for us. We say, wait, I cannot die yet. I'm not ready to die. I have not practiced the Dharma. It's not going to wait for you. So this first trick point is to kind of bring us to a deeper appreciation of the reality of how inevitable is our death, our own death. And the point that down are not difficult. And this first one is said to be not so difficult to realize if you just spend some time thinking about it. Sometimes, even people who may not be Buddhist, we know about it, we may have wheels, or we some people even, I don't know about Singapore, they even went to the funeral home that day. But like this day, there are different options, like even this. What sort of coffin you want, whether you want, you can even there are people who sort of pre-book their funeral to make life easy for everybody. Okay. So, it is possible to live our life understanding, being aware that we are all going to die. So, in the light of that, how do I want to live my life? I will arrange the affairs of my life. This is the first 3 points. Any question about this? Do you feel scared by this? No. Very good. Maybe it's good to be a little bit scared. If you don't feel anything, means the Teflon light off right. So at the end of the day, non-stick. Oh, come and go. Yeah. But sometimes, might be good to let it in a little bit. Maybe not all of it, but just let it stir something up, because then maybe you can initiate some change within our behavior, within our choices. And very interesting, it can even affect our perspective. In the light of that, a lot of things become not important. All those grudges, and all those unhappiness, minor things. You don't have time. You don't have time to deal with all these things. So they kind of, it's easier to let them go. They come off. Don't sweat the small stuff. And then you focus on what is really important. Life becomes much easier, happier, funny, isn't it? But I think quite true. Right. So, don't worry about that, right? Just leave the body there long enough. And clinical death, brain death, sooner or later you will be really dead, say, yeah. Okay. Yeah, the Tuk-tum, I think when they say to have their external sign of death, a cyst, so there is no heartbeat, there is no breath, no respiration, but they believe that, but nonetheless they, I don't know whether you've seen dead bodies, but they have a very different look to them. The skin and if the eyes are open, the eyes basically they look big, right? And what they say is that for some practitioners, even though the vital signs have ceased, the body remains like, they look like alive. They are pinkish. They look as if they are asleep, even though they don't have any. Right? then the Tibetan Buddhists believe that they are in the process of deep meditation. Even though all the physical signs of death, alive, have ceased. And so they don't move, they don't touch the body, they just leave it there for a few days. And then again, we human beings are getting, we got it. Then I'm only seeing 3 days. Oh my Lama, 7 days. And the sort of things that we thought was, and then a really, really special one, like, maybe like 2 weeks. Basically, they are said to be in a kind of meditative state, for a prolonged period of time. This, they're not going to come back, but this is like the final process. And they are able to prolong that final process until, in Buddhism, the complete separation of consciousness from the physical body. That is why it's called death in Buddhism. So for those lamas, that means even though they have no vital signs, certain aspects of their consciousness are still functioning within the body, although you cannot see externally. And that sort of keeps the body fresh. And when that meditation finish, and the link between consciousness and the body cuts forever, then the body becomes a dead body, and it displays all the signs of corpse. So that technical definition in Buddhism is that the link between our consciousness and the body cuts. Of course, there's no. I mean, how are you going to tell, right? That's why in medical terms, they always rely on some measurable thing. There was a group of scientists who tried to capture the EEG of one of these meditators who enter into this clear light meditation. It's called clear light meditation. Basically, the person is, well, you kind of have to put it on or they die. You don't want to disturb the body in that day. Yeah. So you put on that complicated thing and you turn on the machine and you basically wait for them to die. Then after they are dead, you keep the machine going and just to track whether any brain activity. So modern science tends to associate consciousness with brain activity. So you know how hard to do this experiment, right? To wait for someone to die. And then you must get there before they are completely dead. And then you have to fit on this thing, start the machine, and to observe it. First of all, they also give you the position to do it. So eventually they did, the story goes that they did manage to find all things come together, and they managed to measure one person's EEG as they enter into this so-called meditative state and die. But they refused to publish it. So then we asked Alan Wallace, who is a Buddhist teacher, American Buddhist teacher, but he has close ties with all the scientists and psychologists who do this kind of research, consciousness research. And because they didn't officially publish it, you can't tell what on earth they observed in the EEG, right? They observed something. They must observe something. But they refused to publish it because it's only one single sample, right? So it's not conclusive enough for them to publish it in any journal, scientific journal. Yeah. But I think they do observe some activity, some signal. But then again, you never know where the signal comes from. Does the signal correlate with the last bit of meditation? If we're dead meditators, or are there some kind of analysis? Artifacts that come from the decomposition process that trigger the thing. So they don't know. So the first point, first 3 points, talking about thinking about the inevitability of death. So that would be definitely good stuff. For me personally, this point is saying that I do have a message, we're going to do, maybe not today, but next week. There will come a point in time when I will no longer be physically here. the world will continue. But at least me, in this particular form, will not be part of it. And to think in this way and to reflect on what sort of impact that may have on me now, on my choices, what I choose to do or not do, how on my attitude, my thinking, my feeling, and so forth. So that's the first one. That should be an easy one to think about. The next three are difficult. These three are related to the uncertainty of the time of death. Everybody kind of knows that we are going to die. No one disputes. That is an easy one. This one, we don't know when we are going to die. Again, another common sense. But this one is very hard. This one, multiple test for quoted. This one is very hard to penetrate. We put on great resistance to this second idea. Basically, we can die at any time. There's no certainty, there's no fixed time that we can be sure that, oh, I will not be dead. I will only die later than this. But the uncertainty of the time of our death. The three points are, the human lifespan is uncertain. Some of us can live for a very long time, and some of us can live for a very short time. Some of us die even when we are in the womb of our mother. So, and along the way, people die all in every age, every age group. It's not like only old people die, young people will die. It's not like babies cannot die. It's not like young people cannot die. It's not like promising young people will not die. So basically, we die at different ages, under different circumstances. So, our lifespan is uncertain. Second thing is that there are actually more causes of death than causes of living. And even the causes that keep you alive can become the causes to kill you. I always know this, but they're pretty good at figuring this out. Okay? For example, you ask you, what are the causes of death? In fact, there are statistics, but they compile all the causes of death around the world, right? Rank, which are the major killer, that secondary, like automobile accidents, that rank quite high, and then sort of illnesses also, yeah. But there are many, many causes of death. But what are the causes that sustain our life? They're not that many. There's oxygen, air, and then water, and food, and then maybe some kind of protection against the weather, temperature, clothing, shelter, maybe aircon, climate control. Yeah. In Singapore, not only die from this humidity. Yeah. So, and also medicine. But every one of them, although it helps to sustain life, can also kill us. So the medicine can kill you, right? Shelter can kill you, the roof collapse on you, stand on fire. Food can kill you, food poisoning. Water can kill you, water pollution. Air, can air kill you? Yes, polluted air. Well, there you go. Even the causes for life can become the causes for death. Therefore, for sure you're going to die, okay? There's no escape. So there are many causes of death, and therefore, at any point of time, when the causes and conditions come together, death can occur. In spite of our best efforts, because we don't want to die. So that increases the uncertainty of the time of our death. The last one is this body of ours is actually very fragile. No matter how hard, how fit you are, how healthy you are. In fact, some of the tragic news are people that are like super, super fit. You know, they drop dead when they go out for a jog or a run, right? They just die. But, I have a friend that says that, you know, sometimes you always say, oh, eat healthy, exercise, keep healthy. then my friend said yes, and then you will die healthy. Because the health is not, unfortunately, doesn't mean that you, even though you are healthy, doesn't mean that you will die. Okay, you can collide, car crash, and other things can still happen. So, sounds very morbid, but a very important history, this whole idea that the time of your death is actually a very important one, because one of our main problems as far as living a meaningful life or engaging in spiritual practice is procrastination. You always have more time. I can always do it later. But the reality is not like that. Of course, you can postpone and postpone, but sooner or later, there will come a day where there is no postponing. That's it. Your death has arrived. So, when we really think about this whole idea, oh, uncertain, I don't really know when I'm going to die. I really, really don't know when I'm going to die. Which means that every day, every moment becomes precious, becomes important. Important not just for myself, but also maybe for the people I care for, or the close relationship I have. Okay. And just as I don't know when I'm going to die, I also don't know when others are going to die. It can happen very suddenly. And that's why if we have some kind of notion that keep that in mind, it may help us to cherish the important things. The people in our life. Because when change happens, death happens, it can all happen very quickly. And we are not even prepared for it. Whereas if we internalize this idea of the uncertainty of time, that we might appreciate every new day, we appreciate it. And every encounter with others, especially those that we love, it's like a gift. And the fact that I'm still alive and still breathing, it's a kind of wonderful thing. I can appreciate the moment I can take. So how can I make good use of the time that I still have? Because I don't know when or when it will come to an end. So these are the 6 points that I want to present today. Any questions? Super life. Death. Yes. Yeah, that means your data, but you transfer your consciousness, isn't it? Yeah. Where you transfer to, so transfer of consciousness pole or independent pole is a practice in Tibetan Buddhism where it says that you're not supposed to do it to a living person, but only to someone who is very close to death when they're dying. They're definitely dying. And then it's a practice that you do that's supposed to increase your chance to have a good rebirth. Or, even Buddhism also, like, rebirth in some special places, what we call pure land. Yeah. Land places which is supposedly very conducive for Dharma practice. So it's a kind of, like put you on a rocket and propel you, shoot you to your destination. Yeah. So that's for a while. Transference of consciousness. Yeah. But even that, only happens then, it's still subsumed under the main idea of death. Because the whole idea of doing training for power is supposed to train for it before death happens. When death is, when you're dying, it's too late to train for it. So that is still within the same idea that preparing for death. So that in the case that you situation, you get stuck somewhere, you're dying, and then there's no holy being around to help you, and you say, just do it DIY, like do it yourself. And then you can just say, no problem, I will perform power on myself. I will shoot myself to a good rebirth. Yeah. So that's the whole idea, which is why I don't think we do it here, but in some other centers of they organize retreat, where people come together and just practice this technique. It's quite a fascinating technique. And I mean, I have no idea, but just you keep imagining sending your consciousness. Tibetan Buddhism, consciousness is supposed to reside in the heart, not the vagal, but heart center, heart chakra. And this one, you imagine you forcefully force the consciousness. Usually you visualize it in some form, tiny little sphere, and you shoot it, get the momentum and shoot it up. But you're not going to shoot it out of your head. Accidentally, you exit from this life prematurely. Yeah? So you're going to shoot it all the way until somewhere under, like just under the scalp. There's a chakra here, the Brahma chakra. Just underneath that, and then you absorb it back. The most, I don't know if it's true or not, but I heard that you do this many, many times during a retreat. Right? Then when you are supposed to be matured practitioner, like you're proficient, that the bone, I mean, there is a kind of a juncture where the skull is made out of pieces of the bone, right? Not just one open piece. So the connection, juncture between the two pieces of bone here actually open up to there's like a little gap there. And it's big enough that you can actually insert like a plant, like the stem of the plant. It doesn't hit your brain. I don't think it touches your brain. But it's just that the skull part. And you can also sort of like, then you let go, there'll be a branch, like glass. Grass or something like that. Not a big branch. There's not a big hole, okay? Just a little crack. And then it was dead. Another good for keeping up appearance. This is accomplished. Pull up like this. I have a hole in my skull. I didn't know whether it's supposed to be a sign of accomplishment now. But we like to look for physical signs of our invisible spiritual practice, right? No. Practice compassion. Not obvious there, you know, but this one is very obvious, right? Because there's some kind of physical change in your body. Okay, so that's the one. Yeah, I wouldn't say resign, but I think we will acknowledge the reality of that. Oh, of course. That's why I say that you might have a reaction. You react to the topic, how you react to fear. Fear may arise. How do you deal with it? Actually, it's a good sign. Just to say, I talk for 1 hour. Nobody dash out of the door, right? No reaction. Right? So that just goes to show, actually, we are quite resilient, quite resistant. Our telephone coating is very strong. So, how about that? Nothing. Yeah, no one. But occasionally, there's a crack in the telephone. So the idea actually somehow got in. Not just intellectually, but touches some part of us and trigger that fear, the instinctive fear, which actually is a good sign, means some response, right? Instead of all this, in 1 year or another year, something happens. Although the reaction is unpleasant, we don't like fear, and it's unintended, we are not trying to create fear or bring fear. But the fact that we respond means that we have allowed the idea to go deeper to affect us. So I see it as a good sign, but what we need to do is we need to recognize that the whole point of this meditation is not about generating fear. So that is the unintended reaction. So what we need to do, we can pull back, but it's a good sign that we are at least responding to the topic. So what we need to do is to find a way to, if we don't want fear, but we want take it seriously, take this topic seriously in a way that has a positive effect on how we live our life. Okay. So we want to, that's why you have to be a bit more skillful in how you meditate. Think about it. You know, think about it in such a way that you don't trigger the fear, not although you know you can, but you want to think in such a way that bring up the benefit remembering death. But I can say that death is a difficult topic. So inevitably, there are different emotions that come up. Not necessarily fear, but quite a lot of those emotions are not necessarily present. You can feel sad, but sometimes you experience a bit of the grief of loss. You lost somebody, yes, grief, just related to death. Sometimes we also reflect on losses in our own life, missed opportunity, things that we can't go back to change. Yeah. Or we have a sense of, so there are different emotional responses. And all the emotional responses are a good sign in the sense that something is moving, something is happening. Digestion has happened. It's not like the lama thing to sit there and you just carry on. So something is being broken down and some part of it is accumulating, is affecting us. And so then it requires some skill to adjust the attention in such a way that we don't want to focus on the fear, we don't want to feed the fear, but we want to meditate in such a way that we trigger other types of reactions. A reaction that says that I acknowledge the reality of my own death, and then I want to make good use of this life. I make full use of this life. I want to align my life in a way that align with my own true aspiration. Instead of wasting my time doing things that say, other people say I should do. That's also quite common to most people. They realize that usually in the face of death, they realize they've been living someone else's idea of their life. They maybe in order to please their parents, they gave up on their dream, or they sacrificed something. And then usually when encountering death, they realize that, hey, I have done enough of that. From this point on, I want to live my own life. I want to do the things that I really want to do, that is really important to me. That's it. There are many different reactions that come up that you use the word resign. So some people do react to this topic and say, this is quite common because I used to work in aged care, right? So you ask, but then what to look forward to? It's a way around to die. Recently my auntie, I mean she's still in the hospital, answer, this is lying in the bed, right? Think of something to do, give you the mobile phone, call your friend, say, no, I don't want to read this. I don't want to contact my friend. I'm going to sit there, lie there the whole day, and think about things that will probably make you even lower, more unhappy. So, I think there are different kind of reactions that can come up when we talk about them or we think about them. And we need to select and say, okay, this set of reactions are not so helpful, so I don't want to reinforce them. But this set of reactions are what I want to enhance because they can have a positive impact on life. Let's give it a try. Let's do a meditation of that. We won't go through all the 6 points. It's too much for analytical meditation. So we'll just go through the first three that related to the inevitability or the unavoidability of our own death. And so we're going to go down this list of the 3 points. And what I'm going to invite you to do is just use that point, which I will repeat for you. The first one is there is no way to escape from our own death. That's the first one. And the way we meditate on this is that we think about it. Okay. Let me try to find a way to live forever. So that's one way you can meditate. That's, sometimes you don't have to take it too seriously. So you say, actually, I don't really want to die. So let me see, how can I live forever? You're not the first person, right, to think like this. You're not going to be the last, right? So you try, okay, okay. Practically speaking, how can I live forever? So you can think, oh, I don't know what you're going to do. You think about it, okay? And then maybe you will come to the conclusion that actually there is no method to allow me to live forever, which indirectly imply that sooner or later I would have to die. So then, practically they say, they give this image, where can you escape to where there is no death? You stay on land, you still die. If you immigrate, you still die. You go all the way down into the ocean, you still die. You take a rocket and fly all the way to the moon, you still have to die. Is there any location, any place you can escape to where you don't have to die? You know? So thinking like this is to reinforce the first point that there is no escape from my own death. And likewise, second one, just to remind you, that our life is progressively and continuously getting shorter. We are moving closer and closer to our death. Just image that whether you are awake, you are asleep, you are speeding on the train towards the final destination. It doesn't slow down, it doesn't pause, it doesn't stop. It just goes steadily and continuously, second after second, minute after minute, towards our final destination. You are on that train. And then, well, there is an early exit, but you, I'd rather you don't do it, okay? But you will arrive at the final station. The third one is, even when we are alive, we actually devote very little time. We devote very little time thinking about death, preparing for death. Also, we devote very little time on spiritual practice, things that are supposed to help us with death. The time is running out. Okay, so let's do a meditation on this and see what it is. So, prepare yourself in a meditation posture. So the most important thing in meditation with the posture is to see if you can keep your spine, your back upright in a natural way without tensing up your back muscles unnecessarily. Just allow the spine and your room and space to extend upwards following its natural curvature. And those of us sitting on the floor, we cross our legs in whichever way to provide a stable base. And if you are sitting on a chair, you have both feet firmly planted on the ground. If you cannot touch the ground, cushion. Hands and arms, we can rest them in the lap, or we can rest our hands on the knees. And you're most welcome to close your eyes completely during this meditation. So take a few moments, allow your body to find way into your posture. So as always, the first step is acquiring a seat, a supportive seat for your meditation. See if you can allow your body to feel that it is resting on something solid, firm and very stable, resting on your feet, on the ground. And it is well supported and balanced in this posture. In the second step, we take a few minutes just to help body and mind to transition into the meditation, to set aside other things that preoccupy our body, our mind. So for that we can make use of the breath in a very simple way. Place our attention and return our attention to the breath sensation in our body. I'm not saying breath sensation, but the different parts of the body, maybe at the nostrils, also be at the chance. Or you may not suspect the patient at the abdomen. Regardless of where you are, where you observe the breath, see if you can sense the movement of the breath, the wavelength movement of going in and out, expanding, contracting, rising and falling. To help our body and mind settle in the meditation, all we need to do is to return our attention. In this case, return our attention to the breath. Not to worry or be frustrated if your attention doesn't stay in the breath. Your attention may tend to wander off, think about other things. All this is totally normal. All we need to do again and again is simply very patiently and gently guide our attention back to the breath sensation. Coming back to the breath, we are also coming back to here and now, coming back to the reality of this moment, also coming back to the state of your body and mind. Maybe you notice that some parts of the body that feel a bit tight, tense, or uncomfortable. Maybe you feel the mind is agitated, quite active, thinking. Or maybe the opposite, feeling very sluggish, dull, dark, sleepy. Regardless of what you find, if you can rely on the breath, coming back to the breath, especially your out breath, as you breathe out, remind yourself that this is an opportunity to release. As you breathe out, maybe some of those tightness and tension may flow away with the breath. Maybe some of the thoughts also flow with the breath. Maybe a bit of that sleepiness or darkness may also be released with the breath. So returning your attention to the breath again and again, and as you breathe out, reminding yourself to release on your out breath. We do that for a few more minutes, just to help our body and mind to fully settle into the meditation. So allow the breath to be your support in this meditation, something that you can always come back to if you lose track of the meditation, different points that I mentioned to you. Maybe you feel bored, not sure what to think about, or maybe you find the meditation a bit disturbing, unpleasant feelings or sensations arise. at any point of time, feel free to come back to the breath. Pay attention to the breath, to the in-breath and the out-breath. Especially as you become the mind yourself, you can release. Now I invite you to do engaging the first step of the meditation to go deeper into it. In this case, related to depth awareness of depth, the particular awareness of how inevitable it is that each one of us has to die, that we cannot avoid our death. So there are 3 points to this, and as I mentioned, each point, feel free to reflect on it, think about it in your own way, repeat the words to yourself, and see what comes up for you. So the first point is, there is no way I can escape from my own death. My death is inevitable, unavoidable. Yeah, I definitely have to die. It is the same for everyone. The different ways to think about this. Think about the people that you know who have already passed on. Just like them, one day my life will come to an end. I definitely have to die. Coming back to the breath, coming back to the meditation topic, death. Think about the first point that every one of us, including myself, has to die. Another way to reflect is there any means, is there any place I can escape to where I do not have to die? And then the second point, now that there is a fixed destination to this life, there is a fixed end point at which I will have to die. Every moment I am moving continuously closer to that final destination. Be it during the day, the night, whether I'm awake or asleep, whether I'm busy or not busy. Continuously moving closer and closer to that final destination. There's no way I can postpone it. So likewise, coming back to the breath, coming back to the topic of death awareness. Now that this teaching session is coming to an end, we are 1.5 hours closer to our death. stay constant all the time. I'm not continuing in this way. We are always moving constant, constant to that extent. And then the final point, even though we are rushing head on towards the final destination of our path, along the way, the amount of time and energy we devote to preparing for it, to engaging in spiritual practice and dharma, is actually very little. Maybe we manage 10 minutes of meditation a day, or a few minutes of prayer. Maybe we only manage to do it once a week. So the amount of time we devote to preparing for that, to engage in spiritual practice along the way, is actually very little. And as a way to sum up this meditation, ask yourself this question. Are you ready to die? Are you prepared to die? And if not, what will you want to do? What are the things you need to do in order to be prepared to be ready for death that is definitely going to come? So this is another way of doing analytical meditation. Not my favorite, because you need to think a lot and to kind of exercise your brain a bit. You really need to sometimes come up with your own ideas, come up with different points to reflect on. And it's very easy, especially in the guided meditation, to run out of points. Okay. I used to attend Ramasang under my teacher. First of all, my first idea is she has a very soft voice. I don't know whether some of you may have attended that. She has a very soft, soothing voice. So you listen to it. And then I drift off to sleep, right? So usually what happens is she will give the instruction and I will be asleep. When I woke up, she will say, "Now meditate on this." I say, what am I supposed to meditate on? So for the next few minutes, I was left on my own to figure out what could she have said just now regarding the topic. And I'll do this again and again. So when she's not talking, I'll be awake, and when she talks, I'll be asleep. So that's why I don't like analytical meditation. The other thing is, sometimes when people give you an idea, okay, what is there to think about? So if you draw blank, but you try it very hard, I find it sometimes very hard to engage with that particular idea. As in, I cannot elaborate on it, I cannot work with it. So these are some of the challenges when you do this kind of analytical meditation. Any questions, any comments? We have this. How to reconcile the idea of living purposefully versus living in each moment without an agenda. How to reconcile? Quite easy, right? You run out of milk, right? In this moment, there's no milk, right? Then the thought arrives, I need to go and buy milk. So there's a purpose. You walk out of your flat. You are aware of what is happening. Make sure you are aware, otherwise you go in the opposite direction to the supermarket, then you arrive to buy. So there is a moment to moment awareness of what is happening. And there is also an awareness of purpose. So now I need milk, now I go and buy milk, I need to go and see, I'm going to end up somewhere else. So the purpose guides the moment to moment action and experience. Well, otherwise, living in the present moment makes you become like a zombie like that, right? I can't think about the future. I cannot remember. I don't know what I'm going to do. But I just have to stay here. You know what I'm trying to say? Because sometimes we have this idea, oh, this is about the future. Cannot. But you're only in the moment. This is about, no, cannot. There's a fantasy. No, cannot. This is the moment. In the moment, yeah. I'm getting very hungry. So it's not like this. It's the moment by moment is one way of thinking. Reality comes to you like the waves, ocean coming to you, bringing to you the challenge of each moment. You know, one moment maybe I need milk. The next moment is someone that I care is dying. And each moment call for a response. So if you are present, then you are able to recognize what is needed, what is called for in that moment, and then guide you what comes, what to do next. Whereas when we are what we call mindless, we are all lost or caught up in the past, or preoccupied with or just anxious about the future, we miss the signal, the message from reality in this moment. And that's why we, in meditation, we say mindfulness and others come back to the present moment. But coming back to the present moment helps you to recognize what is needed. And then you can plan to this, to that. And that leads you to act in a more appropriate way. So the two are not, they're not going in the opposite, different direction. But actually, they complement one. Living purposefully allows you to live each present moment in the fullest, most appropriate way. And by living each moment in that way, you fulfill your purpose, small or big. The thing about that kind of instruction is, first of all, you are always living in the present moment. Even if you think about the past or the future, here and now. In a way, you never live. You can never be anywhere other than the present moment. And then this whole idea of mindfulness means in this moment is also a little bit too simplified. That we do have a past and we do have a future, we need to That's what people, I think sometimes people get very caught up with this whole idea of being mindfulness. I must be in this. I must be in this. And then nobody lives like this, okay? Practically speaking, occasionally you need to remember, where is my house? You need to recollect, right? Occasionally you need to plan for the future, right? So you have to, and that's the wonderful ability of human beings to be able to remember the past, to be able to anticipate the future. So this whole idea of mindfulness is really like, not so much that every moment of the 24 hours must be here and now, but that relatively speaking, it's important to come back to the present reality and to know what is happening instead of constantly like lost in thought about past and future. But it doesn't mean that every single moment I cannot be thinking about the past or the future or something else. In fact, sometimes if you take it to extreme, I cannot think, but thinking is not the present moment. No thinking, no past, no future, no fantasy. You will be a vegetable, not able to do anything. So that's taking the instruction a bit too literally and too extreme. You know what I'm trying to say? Yeah, when you are present, when you are aware, sometimes you are aware of what is actually happening, other times what comes into awareness are concerns of the future or things of the past. They can also enter when you are open to enter into your awareness. And when appropriate, then we might think a little bit, then speak like discount. So you, it comes to you, and when it's appropriate, we can think about it, then we can act about it. When it's not appropriate, we let it pass. Maybe a past memory come up, past dispute come up into awareness. And then when you're aware of it, you say, you know what, this is past. I don't need to dwell on it anymore. And then I can let that all pass. So that's how we reconcile. By in a kind of open, present awareness, yet at the same time, we can, I won't use the word fixate, but sometimes it's necessary to devote energy to the then, the future, or to problem solve what is happening. So, and we can be very focused on that, what we are doing. And then when that's finished, we let it go, and we get back. When you play computer games, you should just play the computer game, right? And it defeats the purpose of playing computer games. You are absorbed in watching Korean drama. You should let yourself go and allow the emotions to come. Well, it's time like that. But that's when you finish, then you switch off. Because otherwise there's no point watching a drama and be a critic like, oh, this I think is no good. Then you defeat the whole purpose. That's my 2 cents worth of opinion. Right. Thank you very much for your attention. Hope you come back next week. I'm curious about that. But I'm fine if it's completely nobody at all. And next week we'll think about how to live in the life of awareness. Yes. Right. Have a good week. See you.